This is KGNU's Morning Magazine for Thursday, June 3rd. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, people are starting to ditch their masks in line with federal guidance as vaccine supply starts to outstrip demand, but not all have easy access to the shots, especially those deprived of their freedom. We'll hear more about efforts to vaccinate people held in immigration detention facilities. A national healthcare organization is now calling attention to what Children's Hospital of Colorado described last week as a state of emergency for pediatric mental health. And we'll check in with marijuana reporter Leland Rucker for another cannabis report looking at new marijuana laws and legislation in the state. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have the BBC News headlines. Then it's a public affair. Today, we share the first in a six-part webinar series sponsored by the City of Boulder, exploring how we can create an economy in service of an equitable, livable, and sustainable world. Then at 9:30, a mix of eclectic music with the Morning Sound Alternative. All that is still coming up, so stay tuned to your community radio station. First, we'll start with the headlines. Colorado's legislative session is wrapping up with a major transportation package on its way to the governor's desk. Colorado lawmakers passed Senate Bill 260 Wednesday, a $5.4 billion package that would charge a new set of road user fees to fix highways, expand transit, and supercharge electric vehicles. It's the biggest and most complex transportation funding bill ever in the state and includes much of the Colorado Department of Transportation's 10-year priority project plan to address climate change and accelerate the transition to cleaner vehicles. It was a 41-24 vote along party lines, reflecting strong opposition from Republicans. Like many other states, Colorado continues to encourage vaccinations for COVID-19 through financial incentives. The state will enter Coloradans ages 12 to 17 who have received at least one dose of a coronavirus vaccine into a sweepstakes for a $50,000 college scholarship. Governor Jared Polis announced the incentive yesterday. The first drawing will be held on June 7th with a total of 25 Colorado kids eligible to win. The governor said the pandemic has had a significant impact on students and on education, noting an undergraduate enrollment decline over the last year and a half. He said any person in the 12 to 17 age group who has been vaccinated in the state would automatically enter the eligibility pool. Winners will have their scholarship money deposited into a 529 college invest account that will grow over time. The funds can be used for technical programs, community colleges, and credential programs, not just four-year institutions. Outside the South Boulder King Supers Wednesday, volunteers worked to remove a makeshift memorial on a fence surrounding the site of the March 22nd massacre. The Daily Camera reports that after all the items are removed from the fence, King Supers plans to reset the fence facing Table Mesa Drive and cover it in a black fabric sign emblazoned with Boulder Strong, with a mesh covering to protect it. The Museum of Boulder will save and preserve part of the memorial, guided by museum staff in other cities where mass shootings have occurred. Meanwhile, several families and survivors of those killed in the March mass shooting in Boulder want funds raised by nonprofits to be distributed by a specialist, claiming the current process is not transparent. KGNU's Steve Miller has more.
Boulder resident John McKenzie, whose wife Lynn Murray was among those killed, announced that he and three other victims' families and supporters have created a group called Stand Up Boulder to demand that government officials intervene and audit the handling of the donations. The Associated Press reports that Stand Up Boulder is also asking that Kenneth Feinberg, a Washington, D.C.-based attorney who oversaw compensation programs after the 9/11 terror attacks, the Aurora, Colorado movie theater attack, and many other mass shootings. Stand Up Boulder has started an online petition to ask Governor Jared Polis and Attorney General Phil Weiser to audit the donations and to appoint Feinberg. Stand Up Boulder has claimed that the nonprofit Colorado Healing Fund is keeping 5% of their donations for administrative costs and that they are making spending decisions without victims' input, with some of the money going to other nonprofits in the community. Community Foundation Boulder, and the Colorado Healing Fund defend their work and feel there is no need for a specialist. They are saying the entire community was affected by the supermarket attack and that both groups were clear the donation money was not just for the victims' families. They have raised a collective $5.86 million so far. Jordan Feinigan, executive director of the Colorado Healing Fund, said the group has been very clear and open about charging a 5% administrative fee. She added that if someone specifically designates a donation for a victim or purpose, the donation would be sent to the Colorado Organization for Victim Assistance, who makes the direct payments to victims. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
The Colorado Sun reports that state lawmakers have introduced an 11th-hour bill to temporarily reduce property tax assessment rates, hoping to help Coloradans contend with skyrocketing real estate prices and the rising property tax bills that follow. The Senate bill would allow people to put off a portion of their increased residential property tax payments until they sell their property, starting in the 2023 tax year. Sponsors say the bill would preserve government revenue while aiding Coloradans contending with the economic downturn caused by the coronavirus crisis. The average price of a home in Colorado was just over $660,000 in April, up more than 36% over the past year. Weather along the Front Range today, a high temperature around 80 degrees and a low of 54. Warmer tomorrow, around 86 degrees. Then 88 for Saturday and around 80 again for Sunday. Right now, outside our Boulder studios, it's 56 degrees.
Support comes from Code Ninjas in Louisville, Colorado, where kids learn to code by building their own video games. Details on camps as well as evening and weekend drop-in hours can be found at codeninjas.com/co-Louisville.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. State health agencies are continuing to assist people with disabilities who are physically unable to leave their homes to get COVID-19 vaccines. But work is still needed to reach some of the state's most vulnerable residents not already in Medicaid and other databases. Bonnie Silva with the Colorado Department of Healthcare Policy and Financing says, so far, local vaccine providers have been tapped to serve almost 95% of the state's identified homebound population.
Our goal was, how do we leverage local solutions where those are in place? And so literally going county by county, region by region in Colorado so that we could understand what local solutions they had in place and how, as a state entity, we could support them.
Silva's team surveyed city and county health agencies and identified fire departments, ambulance services, and other providers who were able to bring vaccines directly to homes. Vaccines are administered to homebound residents and anyone else nearby who wants one. To reach people of color and traditionally harder-to-reach communities, Silva says regional agencies worked with trusted voices, including church leaders and nonprofits, like ARC of Colorado and the Colorado Cross Disability Coalition.
Call on behalf of maybe a neighbor or a friend, just really make sure that every Coloradan who wants a vaccine is able to get one, and to hear that we have the infrastructure in place to make sure that they are in fact able to get it.
Immigrants held in detention facilities make up another at-risk population that is unable to access vaccines. The American Civil Liberties Union of Colorado sent a letter last week to the Secretary of Homeland Security demanding vaccine access for the more than 500 people detained at the for-profit ICE Processing Center in Aurora. They're making a similar demand for the thousands of people in ICE custody nationwide. The ACLU said over the course of the pandemic, ICE detention facilities have been some of the worst hotspots for the spread of COVID-19. For more on the story, KGNU's Rosana Longo spoke with Anna Temo, Immigration Campaign Coordinator at the ACLU of Colorado.
Please explain why the American Civil Liberties Union of Colorado specifically named the ICE Processing Center in Aurora in its letter calling for the vaccination of detainees.
First and foremost, we know that the ICE Processing Center in Aurora had really poor medical conditions, had high rates of infections, had low staffing, poor training, and that really took a turn into inhumane treatment of immigrants inside of the detention facility. And this was pre-pandemic. The pandemic has really only exacerbated a lot of the problems that are happening inside of the detention facility. And one of the ways that we're seeing the heightened problems inside of the facility is through COVID infections and the high rate of COVID infections inside of the facility. We know that our community members are not getting the treatment that they need, the adequate treatment, the adequate social distancing inside of the detention facility. And we know that we can advocate for folks to get those treatments. And so we want to make sure that we are advocating for the people inside of the detention facility, that our community members are advocating for their loved ones inside, to say we want to make sure that they are getting adequate medical treatment and that they are receiving the COVID-19 shot. And if it's a two-part shot, we want to make sure that ICE is taking charge of securing that person that first shot, but also ensuring that follow-up happens for that second shot.
How does the vaccination strategy in ICE facilities compare to that of other jails? Do you know?
We can see the difference of how vaccines are being distributed throughout the country. We know that huge percentage of Black and brown communities are not receiving the vaccine at the rates as other, as white people in the U.S. We're seeing this at a heightened rate inside of detention facilities, prisons, and jails. We know that we can push our governor, and the ACLU has pushed Governor Polis to ensure vaccinations inside of jails and prisons. But inside of the detention facility, there are so many more people that we have to contact. You have Warden Johnny Choate, who could be pushing to have a plan for vaccination, but isn't. You have ICE Field Office Director John Fabricatore, who is in charge of making sure that immigrants in the Colorado area and Wyoming area are being treated humanely and can create a plan to vaccinate folks, but isn't. We know that the Department of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, can build a plan to vaccinate to make sure that they have adequate social distancing, but isn't. And we also know that President Biden can sign an executive order to ensure that folks are getting adequate medical treatment, that folks are being released from the detention facilities all across the country that we know are overcrowded and are the reason for the widespread of COVID. We know that President Biden can champion and mitigate a lot of the infection rate that is happening at these detention facilities, but he isn't. And so that is why we are calling on all of these elected officials at so many different levels to ensure that communities aren't being left behind. We know that we have enough vaccines. Let's get it to everybody.
What has been the response to the ACLU from the Department of Homeland Security officials after you sent the letter?
To my knowledge, currently, we haven't heard anything, though I don't know if that means that they haven't sent anything over to higher ups than me. But I think the most important thing here to realize is that Immigration and Customs Enforcement is spending so much money of our taxpayer dollars keeping detention facilities that aren't full open. And it's costing us millions and millions of dollars every day, every month. And so if we want to mitigate the COVID rate of infection inside of these detention facilities, first and foremost, we need to start releasing people out of these detention facilities. We want to make sure that folks are getting vaccinated. We want to make sure folks are protected. Representative Crow and Senator Bennett recently introduced a bill, a moratorium on transfers, to try to mitigate some of that risk. A part in there is that you're meeting the social distancing requirements. Anyone that is over that need to be released. I say we need to release all of the people that are inside of the detention facilities so that they can address medical issues themselves and not leave it up to a negligent detention facility that can't even make a vaccination plan for the people that they are housing.
Anything else our listeners should know that I didn't ask you about?
This is not just a border problem. Our communities aren't suffering in a silo that we are immune to. It is in our backyard. We, as Coloradans, have the power to go to our state legislature and ensure that we are protecting our community members inside of a detention facility. And that is something that ACLU is working on. And if anyone wants to participate, move this forward, we always ask you to join the ACLU in helping us make this happen.
Ana Temu with ACLU speaking with us today about a letter that was sent to President Biden requesting vaccination for all immigrants detained in ICE detention centers. For KGNU, I am Rosana Longo.
Children in Colorado and across the nation are facing worsening emotional and cognitive health, as well as lingering impacts of trauma in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic. A new Kaiser Family Foundation report says children of color and LGBTQ youth are at higher risk for negative mental health impacts. Eric Galatas with Public News Service has the story.
School closures, social isolation, gaps in healthcare access, and other pandemic-related disruptions have taken a toll on children's mental health, according to a new Kaiser Family Foundation report. Jade Woodard with the group Illuminate Colorado says toxic stress can change the way a child's brain develops, and parents and those who work with children should keep an eye out for physical symptoms such as head and stomach aches, acting out, or other signs of lingering impacts of trauma.
And as parents, what we really need to do is change our language to stay positive, to stay calm, to take deep breaths and manage our own emotions, and to understand that they've experienced major disruptions as a result of everything that has happened.
Children of color and LGBTQ youths are at higher risk for experiencing significant emotional and cognitive challenges. Woodard says it's important for parents to find time to get away from screens and engage with their kids. She says playing games or other activities are one way to make space for kids to open up in their own time and share their experiences and emotions. Nearly half of parents surveyed in an American Psychiatric Association poll said the public health emergency contributed to mental health challenges for at least one of their children. Vicky Jay with the National Alliance for Grieving Children says the pandemic's impacts could last a lifetime.
We've all been affected by COVID. We've all experienced loss and change and disappointment and trauma this year. And it's not going to be over with. There's not a switch to flip. It becomes a part of who we are, and it's what we take forward with us.
Woodard says as the nation emerges from the pandemic, all families need support, grace, and understanding. She says ensuring that families can access mental health care and meet their basic needs can help kids cope with the impacts of trauma and prevent trauma in the future.
We really must be building communities that are supporting this healing. And so just like a plant is more likely to thrive in a garden with good soil and plenty of sunlight and water, children and families are more likely to thrive in nurturing communities.
This is Eric Galatas reporting for the Colorado News Connection.
And now it's time for an update on what's happening in the world of cannabis with our guy in the know. That's senior editor at thenewsstation.com, Leland Rucker. I'm KGNU's Hanalee Myers. Leland, thank you so much for joining us this
morning.
Good
to be here, always.
So start by telling us about this new passage of a bill that would allow up to 2 ounces of marijuana and what that means.
Yeah, this is kind of an interesting thing. The law is HB 1090, and it would allow Coloradans to have up to 2 ounces of marijuana. Currently, Coloradans are allowed to have 1 ounce of cannabis. And I think the thing about this is that, as I understand it, Governor Jared Polis has been working on this for a while. He issued 2,732 pardons, but these had to be sorted out, and you had to find that it was less than an ounce, because that's what the legal amount is today. And so they came up with this plan to allow him to pardon people for anything up to 2 ounces now. And that's going to make a lot of difference. There's going to be a lot more people that will be eligible for this kind of freezing effect.
And like you said, I hear that he's been working on this for quite some time, going already looking through and being prepared, just waiting for this bill to pass so that they can hit the ground running on issuing those pardons and making sure that the individuals that it would be impacted that they can start addressing those cases right away.
Yeah, issuing pardons is really important here. I mean, it's really important that we not have someone in jail for something that's legal now. But that process is laborious. You know, you have to go through each case individually. You have to make that decision and then issue that freezing or that pardoning. So I think that hopefully this is going to help that a lot and will let a lot more people get those things off of their records.
And tell us about, there's been some other work at the legislature on cannabis. We've got a very complicated bill here that I know you've been tracking for us. Fill us in.
Yeah, I wish I could fill you in a little bit more because it's still up in the air. But the Colorado House of Representatives passed the biggest changes to the state's marijuana legalization rules since the passage of Amendment 64. And it's kind of an attempt to make it more difficult for people who are 18 to 20 to get medical cards. And it's going to restrict access to higher potency cannabis products that involve dabbing or smoking of concentrates from the plant. And it passed, this is HB 1317, it passed 56-8. This is under the direction of Alex Garnett, who leads the House, and it's now in the Senate. It's expected to pass as well. You know, one thing to think about is that one of the elements of it is that the Colorado School of Public Health is charged with looking into research, quote, related to the physical and mental health effects of high-potency THC marijuana and concentrates. And the school's going to get about $1.7 million for that study. And depending on what they find, they could come up with a public education program around concentrates and or tighten restrictions on those products in the future.
And how long is a study like that going to take?
You know, that's one thing that's not listed. And there have been studies. The University of Colorado has been studying the effects of dabbing and concentrates on teenagers. And so there's been some studies out there. I'm not sure exactly how they're going to do this, but you don't want to take too long, you know, before you do something. And yet you don't want to act too quickly.
So tell us about what else is in HB 1317.
Well, this bill, it would provide $1.7 million to allow coroners to report the results of toxicology screens in any suicide, overdose, or accidental death of anyone under 26 years old.
Do you think there's been suspicion there? I mean, it sounds like there might have been pre-existing suspicions that maybe marijuana was involved in those deaths, and that's why they're pursuing this? What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's what they're trying to do, is to find out whether or not marijuana was involved in any of these things. Since cannabis has not been shown to cause death in itself in any way, I'm a little skeptical of that, but we'll have to see what, you know, this is the law and we'll have to see what happens. Another big change is in finding ways to enforce the daily purchase limits. Currently, adults are allowed to buy up to 1 ounce per day. And people have learned that they can go to a dispensary, buy an ounce, and they can go to another dispensary and buy another ounce. And if you're from out of town and you do this and you sell it in Omaha or Topeka, Kansas, it's going to be worth a lot more money. So they're really trying to discourage this. There was even a chain of stores that was caught allowing that sort of thing, allowing somebody to buy an ounce, then wait a little while and come back in and buy another ounce. And this legislation would create a database that would keep track of purchases in real time and hopefully cut that loophole and stop that practice. That's a practice that nobody really wanted, but, you know, it's just one of those things that we have to deal with as things go along.
Creating a database to track individual sales, though, has got to be a massive undertaking.
Well, but we do have a database that tracks plants from seed to sale, so it's not impossible, yeah, but it definitely will take a little time and a little effort for sure. One thing I wanted to mention is that Denver attorney Alex Buescher told Westward magazine that portions of this bill are unconstitutional under Colorado statutes, and it would force doctors to break federal law by prescribing medical marijuana. Currently, medical pot is now recommended by doctors, not prescribed. And those recommendations don't come with a specific dosage or ingestion method. And that's normal with prescriptions. That's what you would do if you had a prescription. And doctors with prescription power must register with the DEA, and that doesn't allow prescribing Schedule I drugs. So this, there might be some legal issues that we get into as this bill goes along, and those changes might come in the Senate, too.
Well, Leland, always a pleasure having you in. Thanks for filling us in on the latest cannabis news. That was Leland Rucker. He is the senior editor at thenewsstation.com. And I'm KGNU's Hannah Lee Myers. Thanks again, Leland.
Thank you, Hannah.
Before we go, let's take a quick look at what's coming up on tonight's edition of It's the Economy. KGNU's Claudia Cragg will speak with Jonathan Capelli of the Neighborhood Development Collaborative, a coalition of 16 Metro Denver nonprofits that build homes for middle and low-income residents and seek to strengthen the network of community-based businesses and services. Here's a preview of their discussion.
Historically, if we're talking about housing, especially in local jurisdictions along the Front Range, you know, in sort of the early 2010s on, it was much more difficult to talk about any sort of housing. And funds that eventually were passed by cities like Denver were passed under great duress to get those bills passed. You'd have hundreds of people turn out and speak against them just in general. So the argument from the affordable housing world often just had to be, well, this is good for the economy, because that was the only argument that would sort of resonate with more conservative entities.
That's coming up tonight at 6 p.m. on It's the Economy with Claudia Cragg, right here on KGNU. Thanks for tuning in to the Morning Magazine today on KGNU. I've been your host, Shannon Young.